This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Invasive species outbreaks often adhere to a common scenario, sort of like the plot of a real-life scary movie playing out in slow motion. One of northern Utah's well-known invasive species recently reminded The Source's Ross Chambliss of a scary movie from his childhood.
Well, go ahead, mister. Look around. See if there's something you like.
So I watched this horror movie again recently. If you're a child of the 80s like I am, then you probably know it. It's the 1984 Steven Spielberg film, Gremlins. It starts off with Rand Peltzer, a struggling inventor played by Hoyt Axton, who visits a Chinatown antique shop looking for a Christmas present for his son, Billy.
Are these things real?
I told you, everything's real.
There, Peltzer finds this cute, furry little creature called a Mogwai.
What is it?
Mogwai.
What's he doing?
Singing. He does that sometimes.
Peltzer wants to buy it, but the elder Chinese owner with a long white beard refuses.
Father? With Mogwai comes much responsibility. I cannot sell him at any price.
But Peltzer, of course, ends up buying the Mogwai anyway from the old man's grandson in secret behind the store. And he takes it home, but not before receiving some words of warning.
Keep him out of the light. He hates bright light, especially sunlight. It'll kill him. And keep him away from water. Don't get him wet. But the most important rule, the rule you can never forget, no matter how much he cries, no matter how much he begs, never, never feed him after midnight. You got it?
Sure, kid, whatever you say.
The reason I bring this up is that Gremlins, it seems to me, can be understood as a parable about invasive species. It goes like this. A foreign critter is moved to a new place. This critter could be a plant, an insect, a fish, or whatever. The foreign critter is relocated either by accident or sometimes on purpose by a person, maybe because this critter is cute or special or useful in some way. But inevitably, in the end, all hell breaks loose. And the rest of the story becomes an exercise in killing it, or at least containing it. Now, it needs to be said that, in truth, most non-native or introduced critters do not become some predatorial scourge. In fact, many relocated species die off in their new homes. Some might barely eke out an existence. Most do not suddenly swell into some swarming mass of monsters. But some do.
I'm Karin Kettenring.
Karin is an associate professor of wetland ecology at Utah State University.
And I study wetland ecology, particularly focusing on wetland plants, wetland restoration, and invasive species in wetlands.
Karin is concerned about a particular invasive species here in Utah.
The species is called Phragmites australis. One of the common names is common reed, but the interesting thing about Phragmites is that people actually use the Latin name, Phragmites, which is the genus, to refer to it.
She says this plant first appeared on the east coast of North America over 150 years ago.
The general consensus seems to be, at least in terms of how it got from Eurasia, which is where it originated, to the Atlantic coast, is that it was used as packing material. So it has these really big, fluffy seed heads, which before the age of styrofoam and peanuts would have been the perfect packing material. And so if people are packing boxes, crates with these Phragmites seeds, and then they show up in a new environment and it can survive in that new environment, then it'll take hold and can spread from there.
Gee, Billy, where can I get one of those?
I don't know. This is the only one I've ever seen.
The Mogwai, or Gizmo, certainly seemed to adapt well to his new environment. That is, until he got wet.
Thanks a lot. Sorry.
What was in that jar?
Nothing, just water.
It turns out getting the Mogwai wet causes him to multiply and regenerate more Mogwai. Water is key to this reproduction, just as it is for Phragmites. Karin says what's interesting about Phragmites is that for over a century, almost 120 years, it just kind of sat there, biding its time on the Atlantic coast before it somehow spread westward.
And more recently, people have been able to kind of piece together what happened. So it was on the Atlantic coast, it wasn't doing a whole lot, But what we think has happened is that we've essentially primed our environment to be the perfect conditions for it. It really does well in high nutrient conditions. And so, for instance, on the Atlantic coast, as more suburban development is happening along shorelines, is the more fertilizer running off of lawns and ending up, for instance, in the Chesapeake Bay and some of the rivers that feed the bay. And so those really nutrient-rich conditions, Phragmites really thrives in. And so as we've seen a lot of development, we saw the cover of Phragmites really increasing a lot. And we think that's also what happened out here in Utah. So it got out here, and our environment is actually a really perfect environment for this species. So it can do well in a wide range of salinity conditions. And it does well particularly in nutrient-rich areas. So, for instance, Farmington Bay, there's a lot of Phragmites there. It's also, there are a lot of nutrient issues.
The outbreak came to Utah around the mid to late 1980s, after the Great Salt Lake had flooded its shoreline for several years.
Basically, much of the Great Salt Lake wetlands were left as this barren landscape, and that was actually the perfect environment for Phragmites to take off. It likes lots of bare, moist, open places with no competition.
Since the early 90s, the plant has exploded, taking over much of northern Utah.
When I try to describe to people where it is, it's basically between about Bear Lake down to Utah Lake and everything in between. There certainly is invasive Phragmites south of Utah Lake, but it's much less dominant. So on the Great Salt Lake in particular, we have more than 25,000 acres of it. And all the along highways, in roadside ditches, you'll see it if you're driving up and down I-15. In Cache Valley, we have it in Cutler Reservoir. We actually have it now in the town of Logan in this one little landslide area. So it's just starting to pop up in other places, even outside of wetlands and roadside ditches.
Like the Phragmites, the gremlins wasted no time in exploiting ways to multiply. One finds a swimming pool at the YMCA. This causes more and more gremlin clones to spring to life. But as for Phragmites, well, they've managed to spread quickly in different ways.
It has these two main ways to spread, which is first by seeds, but it can also spread asexually, so by basically sending out stems below ground or stems above ground. Those are called rhizomes and runners or stolons. We had this assumption that it was spreading mostly by rhizomes and stolons, but then we also saw that it was spreading really, really rapidly across a huge area, and that really can only occur by seeds. And so we did some genetic work actually to try to figure out how much of the reproduction is seeds versus this asexual reproduction, and it turned out that it actually was mostly by seeds.
As it turns out, this Phragmites outbreak has not been good for the ecosystems of northern Utah waterways and the Great Salt Lake, just as the gremlin outbreak was not beneficial for the ecosystem of Kingston Falls. There, an army of gremlins rampage through the town and attack its citizens. They attack Billy's mother. She gets away, but not before shredding one in her blender and exploding one in her microwave. I know, gross. The gremlins then kill poor Mrs. Deagle, who's in a wheelchair, by launching her through a window. They nearly kill Billy's neighbors, too, the Futtermans, by driving a snowplow through their house. They even take over Dory's tavern and harass Billy's girlfriend, Kate. If we're comparing the Phragmites, from a wildlife perspective, they've been doing similar things.
So we're not talking about something that's 2 feet tall. This plant can grow 15 to 20 feet tall. So it's literally towering over you. It's also so incredibly dense that it's nearly impossible to move through. So the stems are so dense, it's something like people might be familiar with bamboo, and kind of when you have a really dense patch of bamboo in somebody's yard. Part of the reason why it's such a problem is because it's so tall and so dense, and also it's a perennial plant, which means that it grows back year after year from the same root system. And what is left each year is lots and lots of dead plant material from the previous year. And so in some places you'll have 3 feet or 4 feet of dead plant material essentially just accumulating over time. So nothing can grow through that environment. There's no light. It's pretty insulated. So the ground will stay frozen longer in the spring. And so any of the normal vegetation that we value for habitat for wildlife, that vegetation basically can't persist in it. Hmm. It's also not good habitat for most wildlife species.
There are exceptions, she says. Songbirds seem to do well, along with some of the more secretive marsh birds. Additionally, biologists say Phragmites might help with sequestering heavy metals in the wetlands that are harmful to people and wildlife. And this raises a good point. Invasive biologists, yes, there is such a discipline, say sometimes foreign species aren't always bad. Sometimes non-native species can play a positive role for ecosystems, and removing them once they're established could even have unintended consequences. Still, for Billy and the citizens of Kingston Falls, the solution to the gremlin invasion is clear. The rest of the story becomes a strategy of slaughter, finding the best, most efficient means for killing off the critters to contain the outbreak. Billy discovers all the gremlins in a movie theater watching Snow White. He manages to explode the theater, and they all burn to death. Well, nearly all of them. They did have to make a Gremlins 2, after all. Some might say the battle to rid Utah's waterways of Phragmites has been a struggle of equal proportions, if not more.
If we had our druthers and there were not air quality issues, we would probably spray for 3 years with herbicide and then go through and burn each year to clear out the dead plant material. So burning is a really effective way to get rid of it. There are huge air quality problems, though, and obviously we cannot be compromising human health for the Phragmites treatments.
Okay, so burning, bad idea.
Another thing that people are using is grazing. So there's actually people are using cattle grazing out in some of these wetlands on the Great Salt Lake. And so the cattle will actually eat fresh Phragmites, and through the herd movement through the Phragmites, they'll kind of pack down some of the old Phragmites that's still persisting there. There also are some concerns, as you might imagine, of having cows in wetlands and them excreting into wetlands and nutrient issues that are already a problem.
Others have found that mowing and spraying the Phragmites with herbicide can do the trick. You have to kill it at its roots or it'll just grow back. Recently, one of the land managers on the Great Salt Lake, the Nature Conservancy, brought a state-of-the-art machine into the frag fight.
I've been spraying frag since 1996, and sometimes I feel like I'm going in a circle, but we gotta try, so.
This is Chris Brown. He's the director of stewardship for the Nature Conservancy. He drives what I can only describe as a floating tank. It's called a Marshmaster, brought up from the bayous of Louisiana, a glorified lawnmower with an herbicide-spraying gun turret on the back. It costs over $160,000.
It's a funny plant. Sometimes you'll spray an area and it'll just die out and it's gone. And then sometimes you'll spray it out and it looks like it's dead, and then 2 years later it comes back. It's just really hard to understand why it does certain things at certain sites, and why sometimes you spray it and it's gone, and sometimes you spray it and 3 years later you're back to square one again.
Brown says they used to use a tractor out here.
But we used to get stuck all the time, and we'd spend 2 days trying to get us unstuck, and we'd have to bring in track hose, and it was a big mess for a long time. But now, with this, we'll be able to get around. We won't have to worry about getting stuck. If we get this stuck, we're in real trouble. And so this will be one way of doing it. We will do some small treatments in other areas that are off an ATV or off the tractor. And then we have usually a helicopter or an airplane that will come in for the big stands. I mean, even with this, it would take us, you know, forever to sit and spray 200 acres of frag, where I can have a plane come in and spray 200 acres in about, you know, 5 hours, which would take me 2 weeks probably, even with this. So yeah, we use everything we can. Like I said, this, the cows, the airplane, the helicopter, whatever.
Karen Kettenring says her graduate students have been experimenting on Phragmites since 2012, testing how it responds to different types of herbicide and when to apply it.
And the goal really is not just to kill the Phragmites, but actually to restore the habitat, to restore the native species that people care about for wildlife. And for the first 3 years, basically none of those species were coming back. We were getting pretty good at killing Phragmites and not restoring that habitat. Just now in the fourth year of the study, we're starting to see some native vegetation coming back, but it's still looking pretty bleak even 4 years after we've started these treatments, and these are representative of what managers would normally be doing, kind of their normal three-year sequence of spraying herbicide and then letting everything recover.
There's not much that's positive to report here, sorry to say. If anything, Phragmites has taught us a lot about dealing with invasive species.
Yeah, I would say in the case of Phragmites and many other species, it's about focusing on how to contain those new pockets that show up. And so in some places, we may have lost the battle if we have 20,000 acres of solid Phragmites, but in other places, landowners might just have a quarter acre of Phragmites or, you know, a couple mussels that have shown up or something like that. And so trying to target those new arrivals and those new invasions before they get out of hand.
Right. Snuff them out early.
Exactly. And that's kind of a broad recommendations that people make across invasive species. You have to take care of those small populations. It's a lot more satisfying to look at the massive stand of Phragmites or massive invasion of a frog in some place and want to just really make a big impact and try to get rid of them. But in a lot of cases, they've been kind of pushed. Those populations are stable and we're not going to be able to actually deal with them. So be strategic about what you're doing.
So there you have it. Be strategic. Be smart. And remember, if your dad brings home a bundle of exotic Phragmites australis for you in a pot, please don't give it water. Don't give it sunlight. And for goodness sakes, don't feed it after midnight. For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
After a short break, only you can prevent spreading the STD of the sea. Also, learn which non-native Utah fish tastes like lobster. Stay tuned.